says he'll give me 1,000 francs when he comes back. I know he won't, but what about it? He looks at Marlowe sprawled out on the bench, lifts the muffler from his eyes, and puts it back again. Suddenly a mischievous grin lights up his face. Listen, Joe, he says, beckoning me to move closer. We'll take him up on it. We'll take his lousy review over and we'll fuck him good and proper. What do you mean by that? Why, we'll throw out all the other contributors and we'll fill it with our own shit, that's what. Yeah, but what kind of shit? Any kind. He won't be able to do anything about it. We'll fuck him good and proper. One good number, and after that, the magazine will be finished. Are you game, Joe? Grinning and chuckling, we lift Marlowe to his feet and haul him to Carl's room. When we turn on the lights, there's a woman in the bed waiting for Carl.
I forgot all about her,
says Carl. We turn the cunt loose and shove Marlowe into bed. In a minute or so, there's a knock at the door. It's Van Norden. He's all a flutter. Lost a plate of false teeth at the Bal Negre, he thinks. Anyway, we get to bed, the four of us. Marlowe stinks like a smoked fish. In the morning, Marlowe and Van Norden leave to search for the false teeth. Marlowe is blubbering. He imagines they are his teeth. It is my last dinner at the dramatist's home. They have just rented a new piano, a concert grand. I meet Sylvester coming out of the florist's with a rubber plant in his arms. He asks me if I would carry it for him while he goes for the cigars. One by one, I've fucked myself out of all these free meals which I had planned so carefully. One by one, the husbands turn against me, or the wives. As I walk along with the rubber plant in my arms, I think of that night a few months back when the idea first occurred to me. I was sitting at the bench near the coupole, fingering the wedding ring which I had tried to pawn off on a garçon at the dome. He had offered me 6 francs for it, and I was in a rage about it. But the belly was getting the upper hand. Ever since I left Mona, I had worn the ring on my pinky. It was so much a part of me that it had never occurred to me to sell it. It was one of those orange blossom affairs in white gold, worth $1.50 once, maybe more. For 3 years we went along without a wedding ring, and then one day when I was going to the pier to meet Mona, I happened to pass a jewelry window on Maiden Lane, and the whole window was stuffed with wedding rings. When I got to the pier, Mona was not to be seen. I waited for the last passenger to descend the gangplank, but no Mona. Finally, I asked to be shown the passenger list. Her name was not on it. I slipped the wedding ring on my pinky, and there it stayed. Once I left it in a public bath, but then I got it back again. One of the orange blossoms had fallen off. Anyway, I was sitting there on the bench with my head down, twiddling the ring, when suddenly someone clapped me on the back. To make it brief, I got a meal and a few francs besides, and then it occurred to me like a flash that no one would refuse a man a meal if only he had the courage to demand it. I went immediately to a cafe and wrote 12 letters. Would you let me have dinner with you once a week? Tell me what day is most convenient for you. It worked like a charm. I was not only fed, I was feasted. Every night I went home drunk. They couldn't do enough for me, these generous once-a-week souls. What happened to me between times was none of their affair. Now and then, the thoughtful ones presented me with cigarettes or a little pin money. They were all obviously relieved when they realized that they would see me only once a week. And they were still more relieved when I said, "It won't be necessary anymore." They never asked why. They congratulated me, and that was all. Often the reason was I had found a better host. I could afford to scratch off the ones who were a pain in the ass. But that thought never occurred to them. Finally, I had a steady, solid program, a fixed schedule. On Tuesdays, I knew it would be this kind of a meal, and on Fridays, that kind. Kronstadt, I knew, would have champagne for me and homemade apple pie, and Carl would invite me out, take me to a different restaurant each time, order rare wines, invite me to the theater afterward, or take me to the Cirque Medrano. They were curious about one another, my hosts. Would ask me which place I liked best, who was the best cook, etc. I think I like Kronstadt's joint best of all, perhaps because he chalked the meal up on the wall each time. Not that it eased my conscience to see what I owed him, because I had no intention of paying him back, nor had he any illusions about being requited. No, it was the odd numbers which intrigued me. He used to figure it out to the last centime. If I was to pay in full, I would have had to break a sou. His wife was a marvelous cook, and she didn't give a fuck about those centimes Kronstadt added up. She took it out of me in carbon copies. A fact. If I hadn't any fresh carbons for her when I showed up, she was crestfallen. And for that, I would have to take the little girl to the Luxembourg next day, play with her for 2 or 3 hours, a task which drove me wild because she spoke nothing but Hungarian and French. They were a queer lot on the whole, my hosts. At Tanya's, I look down on the spread from the balcony. Moldorf is there, sitting beside his idol. He is warming his feet at the hearth, a monstrous look of gratitude in his watery eyes. Tanya is running over the adagio. The adagio says very distinctly, "No more words of love." I am at the fountain again, watching the turtles pissing green milk. Sylvester has just come back from Broadway with a heart full of love. All night I was lying on a bench outside the mall while the globe was sprayed with warm turtle piss, and the horses, stiffened with priapic fury, galloped like mad without ever touching the ground. All night long I smell the lilacs in the little dark room where she is taking down her hair, the lilacs that I bought for her as she went to meet Sylvester. He came back with a heart full of love, she said, and the lilacs are in her hair, her mouth, they are choking her armpits. The room is swimming with love and turtle piss and warm lilacs, and the horses are galloping like mad. In the morning, dirty teeth and scum on the window panes, the little gate that leads to the mall is locked. People are going to work, and the shutters are rattling like coats of mail. In the bookstore opposite the fountain is the story of Lake Chad, the silent lizards, the gorgeous gamboge tints. All the letters I wrote her, drunken ones with a blunt stub, crazy ones with bits of charcoal, little pieces from bench to bench, firecrackers, doilies, tutti-frutti. They will be going over them now, together, and he will compliment me one day. He will say as he flicks his cigar ash, "Really, you write quite well. Let's see, you're a surrealist, aren't you?" Dry, brittle voice, teeth full of dandruff, solo for solar plexus, G for gaga. Upon the balcony with the rubber plant and the adagio going on down below, the keys are black and white, then black, then white, then white and black. And you want to know if you can play something for me. Yes, play something with those big thumbs of yours. Play the adagio, since that's the only goddamn thing you know. Play it, and then cut off your big thumbs. That adagio. I don't know why she insists on playing it all the time. The old piano wasn't good enough for her. She had to rent a concert grand for the adagio. When I see her big thumbs pressing the keyboard in that silly rubber plant beside me, I feel like that madman of the north who threw his clothes away and, sitting naked in the wintry boughs, threw nuts down into the herring-frozen sea. There is something exasperating about this movement, something abortively melancholy about it, as if it had been written in lava, as if it had the color of lead and milk mixed. And Sylvester, with his head cocked to one side like an auctioneer, Sylvester says, "Play that other one you were practicing today." It's beautiful to have a smoking jacket, a good cigar, and a wife who plays the piano. So relaxing, so lenitive. Between the acts, you go out for a smoke and a breath of fresh air. Yes, her fingers are very supple, extraordinary supple. She does batik work, too. Would you like to try a Bulgarian cigarette? I say, pigeon breast, what's that other movement I like so well? The scherzo. Ah, yes, the scherzo. Excellent, the scherzo. Count Waldemar von Schwischeneinzug speaking. Cool dandruff eyes, halitosis, gaudy socks, and croutons in the pea soup, if you please. We always have pea soup Friday nights. Won't you try a little red wine? The red wine goes with the meat, you know. A dry, crisp voice. Have a cigar, won't you? Yes, I like my work, but I don't attach any importance to it. My next play will involve a pluralistic conception of the universe. Revolving drums with calcium lights. O'Neill is dead. I think, dear, you should lift your foot from the pedal more frequently. Yes, that part is very nice. Very nice, don't you think? Yes, the characters go around with microphones in their trousers. The locale is in Asia because the atmospheric conditions are more conducive. Would you like to try a little Anjou? We bought it especially for you. All through the meal, this patter continues. It feels exactly as if he had taken out that circumcised dick of his and was peeing on us. Tanya is bursting with the strain. Ever since he came back with a heart full of love, this monologue has been going on. He talks while he's undressing, she tells me, a steady stream of warm piss as though his bladder had been punctured. When I think of Tanya crawling into bed with this busted bladder, I get enraged. To think that a poor, withered bastard with those cheap Broadway plays up his sleeve should be pissing on the woman I love, calling for red wine and revolving drums and croutons in his pea soup, the cheek of him! To think that he can lie beside that furnace I stoked for him and do nothing but make water. My God, man, you ought to get down on your knees and thank me. Don't you see that you have a woman in your house now? Can't you see she's bursting? You telling me with those strangulated adenoids of yours? Well, now, I'll tell you, there's two ways of looking at that. Fuck your two ways of looking at things. Fuck your pluralistic universe and your Asiatic acoustics. Don't hand me your red wine or your Anjou. Hand her over. She belongs to me. You go sit by the fountain and let me smell the lilacs, pick the dandruff out of your eyes, and take that damned adagio and wrap it in a pair of flannel pants, and the other little movement, too, all the little movements that you make with your weak bladder. You smile at me so confidently, so calculatingly. I'm flattering the ass off you, can't you tell? While I listen to your crap, she's got her hand on me, but you don't see that. You think I like to suffer. That's my role, you say. Okay, ask her about it. She'll tell you how I suffer. Your cancer and delirium, she said over the phone the other day. She's got it now, the cancer and delirium, and soon you'll have to pick the scabs. Her veins are bursting, I tell you, and your talk is all sawdust. No matter how much you piss away, you'll never plug up the holes. What did Mr. Wren say? Words are loneliness. I left a couple of words for you on the tablecloth last night. You covered them with your elbows. He's put a fence around her as if she were a dirty, stinking bone of a saint. If he only had the courage to say, take her, perhaps a miracle would occur. Just that, take her, and I swear everything would come out all right. Besides, maybe I wouldn't take her. Did that ever occur to him, I wonder? Or I might take her for a while and hand her back, improved. But putting up a fence around her, that won't work. You can't put a fence around a human being. It ain't done anymore. You think, you poor, withered bastard, that I'm no good for her, that I might pollute her, desecrate her? You don't know how palatable is a polluted woman, how a change of semen can make a woman bloom. You think a heart full of love is enough, and perhaps it is for the right woman, but you haven't got a heart anymore. You are nothing but a big, empty bladder. You are sharpening your teeth and cultivating your growl. You run at her heels like a watchdog, and you piddle everywhere. She didn't take you for a watchdog. She took you for a poet. You were a poet once, she said. And now what are you? Courage, Sylvester, courage. Take the microphone out of your pants. Put your hind leg down and stop making water everywhere. Courage, I say, because she's ditched you already. She's contaminated, I tell you, and you might as well take down the fence. No use asking me politely if the coffee doesn't taste like carbolic acid. That won't scare me away. Put rat poison in the coffee and a little ground glass. Make some boiling hot urine and drop a few nutmegs in it. It is a communal life I have been living for the last few weeks. I have had to share myself with others, principally with some crazy Russians, a drunken Dutchman, and a big Bulgarian woman named Olga. Of the Russians, there are chiefly Eugene and Anatole. It was just a few days ago that Olga got out of the hospital where she had her tubes burned out and lost a little excess weight. However, she doesn't look as if she had gone through much suffering. She weighs almost as much as a camel-backed locomotive. She drips with perspiration, has halitosis, and still wears her Circassian wig that looks like excelsior. She has two big warts on her chin from which there sprouts a clump of little hairs. She is growing a mustache. The day after Olga was released from the hospital, she commenced making shoes again. At 6 a.m, she is at her bench. She knocks out 2 pairs of shoes a day. Eugene complains that Olga is a burden, but the truth is that Olga is supporting Eugene and his wife with her 2 pairs of shoes a day. If Olga doesn't work, there is no food. So everyone endeavors to pull Olga to bed on time, to give her enough food to keep going, etc. Every meal starts off with soup. Whether it be onion soup, tomato soup, vegetable soup, or whatnot, the soup always tastes the same. Mostly it tastes as if a dish rag had been stewed in it, slightly sour, mildewed, scummy. I see Eugene hiding it away in the commode after the meal. It stays there, rotting away until the next meal. The butter, too, is hidden away in the commode. After 3 days, it tastes like the big toe of a cadaver. The smell of rancid butter frying is not particularly appetizing, especially when the cooking is done in a room in which there is not the slightest form of ventilation. No sooner than I open the door, I feel ill. But Eugene, as soon as he hears me coming, usually opens the shutters and pulls back the bedsheet, which is strung up like a fishnet to keep out the sunlight. Poor Eugene. He looks about the room at the few sticks of furniture, at the dirty bedsheets and the wash basin with the dirty water still in it, and he says, "I am a slave." Every day he says it, not once, but a dozen times, and then he takes his guitar from the wall and sings. But about the smell of rancid butter, there are good associations, too. When I think of this rancid butter, I see myself standing in a little old-world courtyard, a very smelly, very dreary courtyard. Through the cracks in the shutters, strange figures peer out at me, old women with shawls, dwarfs, rat-faced pimps, bent Jews, midinettes, bearded idiots. They totter out into the courtyard to draw water or to rinse the slop pails. One day Eugene asked me if I would empty the pail for him. I took it to the corner of the yard. There was a hole in the ground and some dirty paper lying around the hole. The little well was slimy with excrement, which in English is shit. I tipped the pail, and there was a foul, gurgling splash followed by another and unexpected splash. When I returned, the soup was dished out. All through the meal I thought of my toothbrush. It is getting old, and the bristles get caught in my teeth. When I sit down to eat, I always sit near the window. I am afraid to sit on the other side of the table. It is too close to the bed, and the bed is crawling. I can see bloodstains on the gray sheets if I look that way, but I try not to look that way. I look out on the courtyard, where they are rinsing the slop pails. The meal is never complete without music. As soon as the cheese is passed around, Eugene jumps up and reaches for the guitar which hangs over the bed. It is always the same song. He says he has 15 or 16 songs in his repertoire, but I have never heard more than 3. His favorite is Charmant Poème d'Amour. It is full of angoisse and tristesse. In the afternoon we go to the cinema, which is cool and dark. Eugene sits at the piano in the big pit, and I sit on a bench up front. The house is empty, but Eugene sings as if he had for audience all the crowned heads of Europe. The garden door is open, and the odor of wet leaves sops in, and the rain blends with Eugene's angoisse and tristesse. At midnight, after the spectators have saturated the hall with perspiration and foul breaths, I return to sleep on a bench. The exit light, swimming in a halo of tobacco smoke, sheds a faint light on the lower corner of the asbestos curtain. I close my eyes every night on an artificial eye. Standing in the courtyard with a glass eye, only half the world is intelligible. The stones are wet and mossy, and in the crevices are black toads. A big door bars the entrance to the cellar. The steps are slippery and soiled with bat dung. The door bulges and sags, the hinges are falling off, but there is an enameled sign on it, in perfect condition, which says, "Be sure to close the door." Why close the door? I can't make it out. I look again at the sign, but it is removed. In its place there is a pane of colored glass. I take out my artificial eye, spit on it, and polish it with my handkerchief. A woman is sitting on a dais above an immense carven desk. She has a snake around her neck. The entire room is lined with books and strange fish swimming in colored globes. There are maps and charts on the wall, maps of Paris before the plague, maps of the antique world, of Knossos and Carthage, of Carthage before and after the salting. In the corner of the room I see an iron bedstead, and on it a corpse is lying. The woman gets up wearily, removes the corpse from the bed, and absent-mindedly throws it out the window. She returns to the huge carven desk, takes a goldfish from the bowl, and swallows it. Slowly the room begins to revolve, and one by one the continents slide into the sea. Only the woman is left, but her body is a mass of geography. I lean out the window and the Eiffel Tower is fizzing champagne. It is built entirely of numbers and shrouded in black lace. The sewers are gurgling furiously. There are nothing but roofs everywhere, laid out.